Is there a track? Oh. Okay, so do those slides, can you see them? Okay. Maybe it's just the way the light is here. It doesn't look very good. Mm-hmm. But you can see it? Okay.
It's better from that side than here, than this side.
Okay. So I'm going to talk to you about the, so you've already heard a lot this morning about the program in general. And there are a number of commonalities between the clinical developmental and the adult clinical program. And especially if you're in the neuropsychology stream, then you do, like the neuropsychology rounds and things like that are together with the CD students who are also in neuropsychology. So you end up, I think Joel Katz was talking about that if you're in the health psychology diploma program, you end up with two cohorts, your incoming cohort within the clinical area, and then also your cohort of students who are in health psychology. And by the same token, with neuropsychology, you kind of have two cohorts. You have three cohorts. You have your cohort of students that are incoming together with you and who you take all your courses with, your core clinical courses. Then you also have the neuropsychology stream cohort that is your other cohort. And then your individual lab, your individual supervisor, will have a number of lab students who are more advanced than you, and also undergraduate honors thesis students usually. So that kind of becomes another little family. Most in my lab, it's like a family. So, and I think in most of the labs, the students do feel like it's a family. So, as you've heard a number of times today, we're big. This is, it seems like almost everybody starts off talking about that because it is so striking, and York's psychology program is so large, and even our clinical psychology program is as large as some other entire psychology programs. Just the clinical alone. So, you know, I think with big, the good thing about that is that it offers a lot of diversity. It means that there are a lot of faculty, and they each have a different specialty interest, and so it gives you a lot of diversity of topics and things to study. I think also with big, there's always a concern about, will I get lost in the shuffle? Will I, will I be a number? And so, that we are embedded within the largest graduate program in Canada, and also that this is the largest accredited clinical psychology program in Canada's largest city. And so I think you've heard a little bit already this morning about how we work together to make you, to be able to take advantage of the benefits of being big with that diversity, but also to take advantage of having your cohort and having your little group of eight or your lab or, you know, these other little families that I was talking about, so that you don't feel like you're lost in the shuffle. The other thing about our program is that it's not just, we don't just pay lip service to the scientist practitioner model. We really value both clinical and research work throughout the program. So being in a clinical psychology training program is different from being in one of our five other non-clinical areas. Everybody does research. Everybody works hard on their thesis, their ABC paper, their dissertation, and does good quality research. But we also are committed to clinical training, and it's a professional training model, and so that requires a lot of extra hours. And our faculty are engaged in both clinical work and research. Within the clinical area, as you'll hear, because I'm going to be going through some of the actual specific areas, sub-areas that our faculty specialize in within the clinical area, a number of our faculty do their research on psychotherapy process, and their work is on the outcomes of psychotherapy. And so it's true clinical research in the sense that they are looking at outcomes or trying two different kinds of approaches with different subgroups of clients and looking to see which one has better outcomes. And so altogether, that emphasis on both clinical and research training means that we are a strong exemplar of the scientist practitioner model. So I think one of the ways, because the graduate program handbook lays out the specific degree requirements, you've already heard a lot about that this morning, some of the logistics, the funding, the TA, the model of going through the program, what I want to do is just to give you a sense of the clinical area and who our faculty are and what kind of group you would be coming to work with if you do come here. So within the clinical area, we have, I would say, three or four different sub-areas within clinical, and then a couple of miscellaneous people who don't, it's hard to, they don't pigeonhole. It's hard to fit them into one of these little sub-areas. So the first major area, I think, that the clinical area is well known for is psychotherapy research. And you've heard a little bit about Les Greenberg. He's a famous psychologist. The emotion-focused therapy is his baby, the way, you know, that Skinner is for behavioral psychology. And so, yeah, Les is really well known, and he is recently retired, but a number of his protégés are still here, and we carry on that model. It's his legacy that he's left. He built that up in this department, and he also comes here to lead EFT training workshops. So we have three faculty members within the area, aside from Les, who do psychotherapy research. One is Lynn Angus. And I've asked some of the faculty to give me a little blurb about themselves or something that they would want to introduce themselves to you. And so I'm going to read what they wrote in first person. So Lynn says, "I'm interested in further understanding the contributions of narrative and emotion processes for enhanced therapeutic engagement and treatment outcomes in psychotherapy treatments of depression, anxiety, and trauma. By narrative, I mean understanding and facilitating the integration of client personal storytelling and emotional expression in psychotherapy for new meaning-making and corrective experiences in therapy." So Lynn specializes in narrative psychotherapy. She's also one of the supervisors of the practicum that we have at the psychology clinic. For students who elect to do the optional third practicum, the additional practicum, it's considered an external practicum, although it's down in the clinic. So physically it's on the York campus, but it's considered to be an external practicum. Okay, Alberta. Alberta says that she's most passionate about validating both experiential and common factors models of change processes in psychotherapy, demonstrating that the things we assume cause change or improvement really occur and can be linked to client improvement. Also, she's very motivated to link therapists to client processes and outcomes. Finally, research in psychoeducation in emotional competence for female leaders is another one of her foci. And so I think, Amanda, you've already been involved in working in her lab for a while, right? So you have some experience with that. Okay, and then Henny, which I love that picture, Henny. Henny's research centers on the integration of motivational interviewing into CBT for anxiety disorders. So motivational interviewing, if you've heard of that before, I think that Henny has written the textbook on that. So she's really very well known for motivational interviewing. She has a particular interest in psychotherapy process research, especially motivation, resistance, and engagement in therapy. As a founding member of the newly formed Alliance for Process-Informed Psychotherapy, she also seeks to advance pedagogy and training in psychotherapy through using process coding as a clinical training tool to enhance therapist ability to observe and respond to key therapy processes as they occur on a moment-to-moment basis during therapy sessions. So these three faculty members, together with a couple of others who I'll come across soon, teach some of the core courses that involve the in-house psychotherapy training. So Henny often teaches the MA2 clinical practicum course, and that's your first exposure to actually seeing clients and being supervised by either her or Karen Fergus, who you'll hear about shortly. Lynn Angus teaches the advanced intervention, which is the PhD-1 required clinical course, where you see psychotherapy clients who have a little bit more problems. I think in the first year, the MA2 course, your clients come from, they're referred from the counseling center?
They're both referred from counseling center, but then they get screened for complexity and they decide to which class it'll be.
And I think advanced interventions, some of them might be referred to the clinic.
Yeah.
So that so they're coming from, they're more complex cases in advanced intervention. And Alberta teaches the MA2 psychotherapy theory courses. So there are two half courses. They used to be called Introduction to Psychotherapy, and now they have separate names, but they're two halves of the psychotherapy course. Okay, so another major area within the clinical faculty is neuropsychology, memory, and cognition. So we have five core faculty members within the clinical area who are part of the core neuropsychology faculty. Four of them are up on the screen, so there's myself. My work focuses, seems funny to read this. My work focuses on normal and abnormal changes with aging, changes in memory with aging, with an emphasis on the impact of memory disorders on everyday functioning. And I work together with a couple of colleagues at Baycrest Hospital, which is a hospital for geriatric patients, and we do research on memory and aging, and our lab meets every other week at York, every other week at Baycrest, and my students get co-supervised by those faculty, and we mostly do, we take a cognitive neuropsychological approach to looking at different aspects of memory processing. Gary Turner, who's been on sabbatical this year, works with Bree. He wrote this last year. His research is in the translation of cognitive neuroscience research into brain-based rehabilitation interventions to enhance higher cognitive functioning, meaning executive functioning, in healthy aging and acquired brain injury and brain disease. So this is an approach that he describes as cognitive rehabilitation neuroscience. He teaches a course called Cognitive Neurorehabilitation, which is a required core course for the neuropsychology students. It's the last one that they take toward the more in the advanced PhD years. He also teaches neuroanatomy, which is students take usually after the MA1. He teaches it in the summer term. So usually they take that between MA1 and MA2 years. He uses a lot of cognitive neuroscience methods, fMRI and diffusion imaging, for example, to measure the integrity of functional and structural neural networks and to investigate how brain changes relate to cognitive functioning. And then this informs the design of behavioral and neurostimulation interventions to try to improve cognitive functioning in these populations. His lab is over at the Sherman Building, where we have a scanner, an MRI machine over there. Shana Rosenbaum also does a lot of neuroimaging, and her lab is also over in Sherman, but Gary and Shana's offices are here in BSB. So Shana studies the neural basis of impaired episodic memory, so memory for past personal events, and spatial memory, as well as techniques to help remediate areas of memory impairment in neurological patients and with neuroimaging methods, MRI and event-related potentials. So she's developed a number of real-world behavioral tasks, including mental navigation tests based on real-world neighborhoods in which participants have navigated over many years, and future imagining and decision-making tests, such as deciding whether to accept an immediate smaller reward versus a future larger reward, and how brain damage can affect that type of decision-making. So Shana is more than just a rising star, she is a star at this point. I guess she's still rising, but she's won pretty much every single award along the way. She did her honors thesis with me many, many years ago, and even her honors thesis was published in the Journal of Neuropsychologia, which is, it's like one of my best publications. And for her, it was an undergraduate work. So she has, just throughout her career, she's won the Early Career Research Award from the International Neuropsychological Society, from the Brain Behavior and Cognitive Science Society, from the university, the major researchers, the inaugural Early Career Research Award for York. I mean, she's just a fabulous researcher and a wonderful clinician and instructor as well. And then Norm Park works on, mostly he studies Parkinson's disease and whether they can acquire motor procedural skills but at a slower rate than healthy adults if you give them sufficient practice. More broadly, his research examines the relation between motor procedural memory and declarative memory, especially as those processes contribute to goal-directed naturalistic actions. So he studies complex skills that have multiple components in them, action sequences, and how people can learn those things after they sustain brain damage. So Norm teaches one of the core MA courses that's required for all the clinical students. It's not a neuropsych course. There's a course called assessment that you do in the MA 1 year. One half of the course focuses more on personality assessment and the other half more on cognitive assessment. And Norm teaches that half. On a cognitive assessment. I already told you what Gary teaches. I teach the human neuropsychology history and syndromes, which is one of the core required courses for the neuropsychology program. Shana teaches a graduate course in cognitive neuroscience. It's not a required course, but it can be done as an elective course. Okay, within the clinical area, we also have a couple of faculty who do work on schizophrenia, different aspects of schizophrenia. So Walter, who's also a core faculty member in the neuropsychology area, does the neuropsychology of schizophrenia. So as he says, most people with schizophrenia have cognitive impairments in attention, memory, and reasoning, along with psychotic symptoms, including delusions and hallucinations. However, a small minority seem free of these impairments, yet they still experience the same severe psychosis. And so his lab studies these exceptional patients who have the psychotic features, but they have relatively good cognition. And he studies the clues that they provide for understanding what's wrong in the brain and what influences recovery and adjustment in serious mental illness. So he's in the neuropsychology stream, but he also is very expert in psychotic disorders in general and in schizophrenia in particular. And he teaches half of the MA1 Foundations course, which is required. That course has recently been broken up into two halves, and one half focuses more on anxiety and depression, what we would call, I don't know if people call it any more than neurotic disorders versus the psychotic disorders. I don't know, or what's the current term for the breakdown between those two halves? The
mood disorders?
On the one hand, and then he focuses more on the more serious mental illness, I guess you would say. But so the course is broken up into two halves. It's taught by two different instructors, and it always has been, but it used to be a full course. And now we said, well, since it's two instructors and it's two separate topics, we have broken it up into two half courses. Okay, and then Joel Goldberg, who you see here with, anybody know who that is? It is Rick Mercer. Yeah, he got an honorary doctorate here a few years ago. So it's a nice picture of Joel and Rick. So Joel is in the clinical area, as you heard this morning. He's also the chair of the whole department. And he studies stigma. And in particular, what he notes that a key barrier to getting help for mental health problems has been stigma, including self-stigma, which means that's when people internalize societal stigma into feelings of embarrassment and shame. And so his research group has been exploring ways of reducing stigma and self-stigma. Teaching people knowledge is important, and trying to change biased attitudes can be convincing sometimes. However, it's actual contact with someone who has mental illness, giving people a chance to hear their story, that makes a big difference in reducing social distance and has real impact on becoming more willing to seek help for your own mental health problems. So he's been working with McMaster University medical students to deliver presentations to high schoolers about mental health. They also talk about celebrities who've disclosed challenges they face with mental illness. But the real highlight is having students listen to a person with schizophrenia who tells her story of overcoming auditory hallucinations and delusions. He's also been exploring cultural factors, the role of peer and parental supports, and personality vulnerability factors such as perfectionism, all of which are related to self-stigma and seeking need of treatment for mental health problems. Okay, then he gives a summary of what he said. I think it's clear enough like that. Okay, so they both study schizophrenia, but one from the cognitive aspects and the neuropsychology and test performance, and the other with the aspects of psychology that are the aspects of schizophrenia that are in mental health in general, about the problems people have in getting treatment and in seeking treatment and what can be done about that. So Joel is very involved in our clinical program. Despite being the chair of the department, where he could get some release from his teaching, he's a very active course instructor in our program. So he teaches half of the foundations course. So I mentioned that Walter sometimes teaches that half with the severe psychological disorders. But Joel, I think in recent years, Joel has been teaching that.
Jen Mills.
Yeah, but I didn't get to her yet. But she doesn't teach the schizophrenia half.
No.
She teaches the other half, yeah. So Joel or Walter usually are the ones who teach. Joel's been doing it in recent years. He teaches that half of the foundations course that focuses, and he would be doing it next year if for any of you who end up coming here next year. And he also teaches half of the PhD 1 psychodiagnostics course. So I mentioned that in PhD 1, you do advanced intervention, which is the psychotherapy course, and it's also the time to start learning psychodiagnostics and getting beefing up the assessment skills. And so Joel team teaches that with an outside faculty member, an adjunct faculty member, Ed Glassman, who used to be on faculty at North York General Hospital. He retired from North York, and then he came here to teach with Joel for the psychodiagnostics course. And recently, that course has also implemented a hands-on component where you actually get to do a psychodiagnostic. The class together, I think, does one psychodiagnostic assessment of a client seen through the clinic.
They do it in teams of three. They do it in teams of three with actually one of our clients from MA2. And then they present the case. So if your client gets chosen, you get to see an overview of the results of your own client done by the PhD 1 students.
So it's a nice way to have the mentoring between the MA2 and PhD 1 students. When you're in the junior role, then the next year you're in PhD 1 and you get to be involved in the assessment of a client from who's being seen for psychotherapy by one of the MA2 students. So it's a nice model. Okay, so you've heard a little bit from Joel Katz about staying healthy and you didn't hear about staying pain-free, but you've heard that Joel Katz talk about the Health Psychology Diploma Program. And so we have two faculty members, Karen Fergus, who she looks at dyadic coping and couple resilience in general, and specifically she's been working on the development and testing of an online relationship enhancement workshop for couples coping with breast cancer and qualitative inquiry into psychosocial challenges after cancer treatment, such as struggles in relation to body image, sexual impairment, loss of fertility, dating, starting new relationships after cancer. So in particular, women with breast cancer and ovarian cancer are at a young age and often, and they're a young adult age, I mean, and they affect a lot of the things that are involved in what makes you feel feminine, or things about your body are being affected as you're entering a relationship, or it changes a marriage for some people, and all of these things, you know, losing a breast, losing your hair to the treatment and things like this can have a really big impact on women. So she looks at, I didn't mention on mine that I do some work with breast cancer patients also. I look at the cognitive effects of chemotherapy in breast cancer patients, because some people talk about brain fog or some of these feeling kind of like a tired brain, really, some people experience from the chemotherapy. And that's not from having a brain cancer, it's just from the chemo itself in breast cancer. And Karen treats these patients in a completely different way, looking at the psychosocial aspects. And so that is an aspect of health psychology. And so she, some of her students do their PhD with her, and they also complete that health psychology diploma program. Joel Katz, he didn't mention it at the thing, but he's a world-renowned pain researcher. He has won a lot of awards, and he's a Canada Research Chair in pain research and pain medicine. So broadly speaking, he's interested in the psychological, emotional, and biomedical factors involved in acute and chronic pain. His students, colleagues, and he together have been exploring risk factors and protective factors involved in the transition of acute time-limited pain to chronic pathological pain after surgery, accidents, or spinal cord injury. They also evaluate preventive interventions designed to minimize acute postoperative pain and the transition to chronicity. So he works with clients, you know, people who go in for some types of surgeries know in advance. If you get in an accident and you have a pain syndrome, you can't really plan for it. But if you know that you're going to have the surgery and you're going to have a lot of post-surgical pain, there are things that his team looks at. You heard that one of his former students looks at Hatha yoga and its effectiveness in working with people with different kinds of disorders, pain disorders. And he looks at other types of mindfulness and meditation and ways of dealing with pain aside from medication, expectations, all the psychological aspects of pain. So he's terrific. He's very nice and he's very involved. And he loves to be on students' committees. He loves to read papers and he's always on all of the research adjudication committees. So even if you don't work with Joel, if you want to do an ABC paper or something with him or attend his seminars, he's very approachable and he's very interested and committed to student training. So he's a wonderful colleague. Karen is too. Karen also, as I mentioned, specializes in qualitative research. So some of our students who are in other areas of research, not psychosocial oncology, but they do qualitative research, sometimes we'll consult with Karen for help on that. And Karen teaches the MA2 in-house clinical practicum course. So when you're seeing your very first clients, so it's Karen and Henny are teaching that course this year. Right. And all three of you are taking that course right now. It's a good way to start off your first experience with psychotherapy with either one of them as your primary supervisor, I think. So. Okay, and then adding variety because I didn't know how else to describe some of our other faculty. So Jen Mills, she specializes in eating disorders and body image, and a number of her students also complete the health psychology program. So Jen says, my research currently has a few related branches centered on body image and eating. One branch of research looks at the role of motivation in the treatment of eating disorders. She's interested in how clinicians can improve the success of eating disorder treatments by enhancing patients' level of motivation to recover. Another area of research looks at the accuracy of body image and how repeated body checking behaviors like taking photos of or weighing or visually scrutinizing one's body interferes with a coherent sense of one's body size and shape. And she's also working on research with collaborators in Australia on whether body dissatisfaction reduces motivation in and enjoyment of sport and exercise participation and how that can be circumvented. So Jen has done both of her two sabbaticals that she's had. She spent the year abroad in Australia, moved her whole family over there, and she has these very close colleagues that she works with. And I think some of her students from here can get involved in that research as well. And Jen teaches two of the MA1 courses. So she teaches half of the Foundations course, focused on mood disorders, and she also teaches half of the assessment course, the half that focuses on personality assessment. So she does one of those in fall and the other in the winter, and the result is that if when you enter the program during the MA 1 year, you have Jen for the whole year as one of your instructors. Okay, so Miriam Mongrain, a few of you mentioned that you're here to see Miriam today, and Davey works with Miriam. Miriam is an active clinician and researcher. And her research has focused largely on the role of emotional dependence and self-criticism in the occurrence of major depression. Recently, she's examined the effect of brief positive interventions for the amelioration of mood in large community samples. These interventions have been administered online, and they focus on growth and resilience. An emerging interest is in compassionate action as an antidote to depression. So in general, her field of psychology is called positive psychology. And that's still a current description of the work that she's doing, right? Good. Yeah. So I know she has these very enviable research samples because she does some of her work online, and she, you know, she can get so many people to participate, as opposed to those who do neuroimaging or something where, you know, it can take a long time to get six subjects, participants, I should say. Okay, and John Eastwood. John's research focuses on understanding the interrelationships of emotion and attention. He's interested in exploring these interrelationships from multiple perspectives. So, for example, he studies how attention is allocated to affective and socially relevant information, the influence of mood and motivation on attention, the emotional outcomes of engaging in different kinds of cognitive tasks, and the emotional consequences of attention failures. So he seeks to understand basic mechanisms common to all, and then examine how these mechanisms may differ between individuals. Currently, he's actively exploring the interrelationships between boredom, which is the affective experience associated with mental effort, and he's looking at the interrelationships between boredom and the affective experience associated with mental effort and attention. Ultimately, his work will guide the creation of psychological and environmental interventions for individuals with attention deficits. So, and John teaches half of the advanced intervention course, that PhD 1 course where you see psychotherapy clients. Okay, so this is just a little diagram showing some of the various things that that the faculty in our department, different populations that we work with, and the unique strengths of our department are that students learn a variety of approaches, including CBT, emotion-focused therapy, motivational interviewing, psychodynamic, and constructivist systemic approaches. I should say that Dave Reed, who recently retired, still teaches one of our core courses in complex systems.
Approach to interpersonal change.
Complex systems approach to interpersonal change. Yeah, we call it complex systems for short, and I forgot what the full name is. And so Dave does a lot of couples work, and students also get some program sanctioned hours in that course. They get to actually do some clinical work as a part of the course. We provide careful and thoughtful integration in contrast to just an eclectic approach. So you'll learn about what the difference is between eclecticism and integration in psychology. They're not the same thing. And we build on strong client-centered foundation that includes the importance of the therapeutic and working alliance. So I think York is well known for this client-centered approach in general. Emotion-focused therapy, less is approach, is a major type of client-centered therapy. And so even our neuropsychology students, when they go and are focused on doing neuropsychological assessments, the supervisors always comment on how good they are at that working alliance, on that therapeutic relationship building to get the best performance out of the client, at noticing different moment-to-moment fluctuations in the client. That those psychological aspects that you get from the therapy training here really transfers over into assessments as well, whether it's neuropsychological assessment or psychodiagnostic assessment. So I've already mentioned this, that we offer two in-house practica where students are supervised directly and intensively by clinical faculty, and I think that that's a real strength of our program and something that you don't get at other centers. And the diversity of training opportunities from psychotherapy to clinical neuropsychology is really quite a strength of this program. So we are rigorous in our process research and expertise that is rare in the world and for which York is known internationally. So we get diversity, breadth, collegiality. All of our faculty tend to get along with each other. The students tend to get along with each other. Even though, you know, obviously there's some competition when you're all applying for scholarships at the same time and there are only so many that go out. But our students are very competitive and very successful in getting external grants. And so even though you're competing with each other, there are enough awards that one person will get a SHRC award, one will get a CIHR award, other ones get OGS. Then we also have students who apply to specific foundations, the Multiple Sclerosis Society, or the Head Injury Society, or the Pain foundation or ministry or things like that, that where they can get some additional funding. Innovation, so several different psychotherapy techniques that have been developed here, the motion-focused therapy, motivational interviewing, openness combined with scientific rigor. I think that's what we bring to bear. And these are some testimonials from some of our previous graduate students. So we're encouraged to use ourselves to build the kind of relationship with clients that research shows creates the best therapeutic outcomes. These are obviously selected quotes, but they're quotes from the alumni surveys that we get. So just like Joel Katz was saying, that he calls up people after they've completed the program to find out what they liked, what they didn't, and we also send out alumni survey. So we have our own clinic where students can gain clinical experience from the very beginning, as well as the high quality supervision that students receive, that those are two of the strengths of the program, and that we receive training in a range of therapeutic modalities, and most importantly, an emphasis on learning how to integrate across various modalities. We have an opportunity to learn from very accomplished professors who take the time to get to know you and care about your growth as a clinician. We get training with faculty who are leading researchers in their chosen evidence-based model, such as motivational interviewing, CBT, EFT, or narrative. And this really puts York students at the leading edge of new developments in psychotherapy. So this doesn't sound like they quoted any of the neuropsychology students, but our neuropsychology students get some of the most competitive internship placements and jobs afterwards. So everybody from beyond the GTA recognize the students who come out of York's neuropsychology program. It's already very, very well known in Canada, and I would say even outside of Canada. So we've had our students go to Emory, to Harvard, to Duke, to UCLA, some of the really top training places for internship. And the one other thing that I meant to say is that we have a new faculty member, and so he's not shown on here yet, but Charlie Taylor, who's coming from San Diego, will be joining the faculty starting this September, and he specializes in CBT for depression and anxiety. That's what his research is in, and so he'll be on faculty, and starting in this next year, he'll be helping supervise some of the students in the advanced intervention course. I think probably by the year after, he'll be teaching the foundations course, that MA1 course. So I am happy to answer any questions that you might still have after. I know we had some questions this morning, but if there's anything else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it seems like there's more broad therapy instruction. Like, I know some schools it's just CBT focused, but could you talk more about how your treatments are with different types?
Yeah, so York is really known for the client-centered model.
Oh.
So within the client-centered, I think that there are a couple of different, you get training here in emotion-focused therapy and narrative therapy, depending on who you work with, but also depending on the presenting problems of the client. So because you're doing, you see only one client in the MA2 year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the first in-house practicum, you're getting one client with one supervisor. You're going to probably have one approach with that client. But in the advanced intervention course, you get two clients over the course of the year. And then, as I said, you also have opportunities for program-sanctioned hours in the clinic, and you have the external practicum placements. So some of our students, and now with Charlie coming, he's a specialist in CBT, so we'll be getting more of that in-house. I think previously our students tended to get more, if they got CBT training, it would mostly be at an external practicum site. So, you know, over the course of your training, you're doing therapy. And if you're in the general clinical stream and not the neuropsychology stream, you have your individual supervisor. So you're doing research with psychotherapy, and so usually you're seeing clients or you're analyzing data that have been collected as part of a larger research study, doing coding, and most of our faculty, as I said, do emotion focused, or so you would either be doing narrative therapy with Lynn, or emotion-focused therapy with Lynn, or with Alberta, motivational interviewing combined with CBT or not. So some of Henny's studies have two groups, when one who gets motivational interviewing by itself, and the other one gets motivational interviewing plus CBT. And so you would get part of that additional training through your research as well. Does that answer it? Okay. Yeah, and then anything that you want in addition. So some of our students who really do have a very strong client-centered background and they want more CBT, they have the opportunity to run groups in the clinic as well. So you can run be part of a group for running CBT for depression or for anxiety, for example.
We'll tell you more about that at the clinic tours.
One question. As you mentioned, it's important for someone who's interested in clinical neuropsychology to have a strong clinical foundation. And it seems like in the master's years, students typically build that clinical foundation, and then in their PhD years, they do practica in neuropsychology. So how can you ensure that during your PhD years, you're also honing those clinical skills?
Yeah, so no, the PhD continues with the clinical training. So the advanced intervention is done in the PhD 1 year. Psychodiagnostics is also a PhD course. Then you do the external practicum has to be on neuropsychological assessment. But you can continue to be seeing some clients through the clinic, and you can do the optional third practicum. So we've so most of the people who go through the neuropsychology stream plan to become a clinical neuropsychologist afterward. So they have that background in clinical psychology and psychotherapy, but they're really not going to do that psychotherapy in their practice. We have a current student who's just going on internship this year, from Shana's lab, who did her optional third practicum in the clinic doing emotion-focused therapy for trauma. And she wants to build a career doing psychotherapy with neuropsychology populations. So like, say, people who have head injury and who have problems afterward with impulsivity and adjustment and decision making, and they have a number of different problems that are a part of their head injury, and so she can do therapy with them. So she has the therapy skills and the understanding of the brain damage. Or running support groups for families of carers for people with dementia, or you know, things like that. So in many cases you can combine that kind of training. So it just depends on your interests.
I'm not entirely sure what your committee is when you're doing a thesis. Can you just explain a little bit more about that and the process of selecting the committee? I'm not sure. It's
the committee? So for the MA thesis, you do you have your supervisor, and then one other person is your thesis committee. And then at the oral examination for your thesis, you have two external. There are two more examiners on the committee. For the dissertation, you have your supervisor plus two other people who are on your committee. And your supervisor will work together with you to find the person who's appropriate to be on your committee. So like I said, I do my research at Baycrest Hospital with my colleagues there, so they co-supervise my students. So they're on my students' committees. And then they have an adjunct position here. If you were to come in and work with Alberta, then usually it would be somebody like Henny or Karen or Lynn, you know, one of the other clinical faculty members would be the second person on your committee. Okay, so I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you might have if you think of them later, and I'm gonna